past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Blah, 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 blah.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. It's okay that you're out there. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
Everyone's so chipper today, you'd think there was a three-day weekend upon us.
Oh,
unbelievable.
No. Ladies and gentlemen, those of you who think that Mark Maron does nothing but mock religion, pay heed.
He is
wearing a Dexter Avenue Baptist Church t-shirt direct. From Montgomery, Alabama.
I've had this for years. For years. And, you know, I've had a lot of, not trouble with it, but it's like, I went down there and I went to the King Memorial, and this is where Martin Luther King first started.
Yes,
preaching.
That was where he, yes.
And I visited this church, and this was a while back because my buddy and I took a trip across country. But just like you said this morning, you're like, what are you doing with that shirt on? I've had to deal with that from black people throughout the history of this shirt.
Well, you know what? The shirt has history because it was at the Dexter Avenue Baptist Church where the Montgomery busboycott was first hatched.
Right.
In 1954.
Exactly. Right. And I go to the post office one day, and this woman's like, where'd you get that shirt? And I'm like, I went to the church. He said, oh, you did?
Oh, you're all right.
Yeah, right. You're
now, if you said, I got it off a brother, you'd have had a problem.
Everybody said, I got it at a flea market. You'd say, that's
no good.
So, man, I feel okay today, but I had a butter problem yesterday, my friend. We go to that meeting.
Oh, we had a staff meeting.
We go to the staff meeting. Right, and they have the lunch, right? And then they have the cookies. Then out of nowhere, bam, this cake the size of a car comes out with an inch of buttercream on it. And everyone's already eating dessert. And I'm feeling bad for the cake because it's sitting there and no one's touching it. So I got to eat half of it. What the hell is wrong with me? Like, everyone had left the conference room and I'm sitting there eating this cake by myself.
Just you and the cake.
Oh, it was ridiculous.
I'll tell you what was ridiculous. Dan Pashman shoveled more salad onto a plate in the middle of a presentation. The room was all dark, and suddenly you see Pashman sneaking up to this bowl of salad and spooning spoon after spoon after spoon on a plate.
He's got that same problem I do.
Really?
Yeah, which is the weird diminishing buffet syndrome. The idea that not only do you have to get to the place with the free food before everyone else does, so you can get there before anything runs out. I mean, P.W. McDonald and Pashman were like, oh man, hey, if you get there before us and it looks like the sandwiches are getting taken up, stack us some sandwich. So me, Joey codependent, I get there and I'm like, oh, I better get the fellas some sandwiches.
You stashed them a half dozen sandwiches.
Yeah, I stashed them like four roast beef, and they get down and they're like, God, I hope these are okay, fellas. You know, what the hell is that? You know, and then it's ridiculous. And then the cake, but Pashman's got that same thing. For some reason, when there's free food, even if it sucks, which it didn't.
It didn't.
You feel it's your responsibility. It's like, I'd hate for this to go to waste. It's better off I ruin my day by eating half a cake. I'm still sitting here now thinking, I wonder if there's that cake down there. Kayla, did you eat any of that cake?
No, I didn't eat any of the cake.
I tried to get you to eat the cake.
Well, I didn't eat mostly because you were angry at the cake.
Of course I was angry at the cake.
Like the person brought it out, and you're like, what is that? Like, what are we going to do with that? It's cake?
The woman almost quit.
She didn't know what was going on. She's like, oh, I'm just going to cut it. I'm like, but why is that here? What are you doing?
What are you doing to me?
And I was right. I had to lay down yesterday. I had to get home and take my pants off and lay down in order to get to deal with myself. I was like a sick person. All I could think of was like, I have to get home to take my pants off or I'm going to be in trouble. I ate half of that cake. Half of it.
Waterbed, baby.
All right, so, okay, there's news to be hatched out. And by the way, hey, have a great weekend. It's only 215 a gallon, national average.
Yeah.
215 a gallon. Unbelievable. That's 9 cents down from a month ago, but it's 15 cents higher than last week. That sucks.
Well, you know, here in New York City, that 215 translates into about 225, 235. California, about the same thing. So a lot of major population centers are say 215. Why, we haven't had 215 since last year sometime.
And also, we want you to get Sitco if you can, because that's Riley's pet
project. Empower Ugo!
Yeah. So, but don't let that rain too much on your weekend. There's still some fun to be had. Three-day weekends are very exciting. The weather looks like it's breaking here in New York a little bit. You see that? It looks like the clouds are breaking. I don't know if it's going to hold. And also, the Democrats had a little fun yesterday.
Oh, you mean with Officer Joe Bolton? John Bolton.
Yeah, they said 3 days ago that we're not going to filibuster unless we absolutely have to. And I guess yesterday they had to.
They gave Bolton the collective finger. They're not going to be able to take this up now until June 6th or 7th, after they come back from one of their many breaks.
Now, let's talk about some of the nuances of this vote, because a lot of people, myself included, I didn't quite understand, because I am no wonk by any means. Mm-hmm. I did not quite understand why Senator Frist voted nay on cloture, which cloture, to those of you who don't know, which I didn't know until I took this job, is a vote to allow a vote.
There you go. A vote to allow a vote. And Bill Frist voted against it as
the only Republican.
Yes, the only Republican. Arlen Specter, by the way, was not there. He was not present. But Frist voted this way so that he can bring this issue back up again as House Majority Leader. That's why he did. It was just a procedural thing.
Okay, so now John Bolton it cannot be confirmed until they go up for a vote again. But now this is because there is some classified information that needs to be... You know, obviously this guy is a toxic disaster.
He is a mess.
He, you know, he's somebody that is causing tremendous problems because he's a loudmouth. He's a bully. He's coercive. He has no respect for the institution of the United Nations. He's dirty, and now there's new charges that he was operating spies were out of Syria.
Well, here's the problem that John Bolton has. He has admitted to the Senate committee before, which I believe was Foreign Relations. He has admitted that he asked for transcripts of intercepted communications involving people that he knew. And this was communications that were intercepted and classified by the National Security Agency, headed by Stephen Hadley, previously headed, of course, by the current Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice. At issue here is the question of whether or not the White House will turn over classified documents regarding, you know, exactly how much of this Bolton was actually doing, because initially, when he first admitted it, they thought it was within certain parameters. Now they think that he was doing a lot more of this. In other words, asking for a lot more of these classified communications, and by the way, sharing some of the information contained in that classified information with the people who were being spied on by the NSA.
So this is all dirty, delicate business.
It's all dirty, delicate business, but it also means that in addition to being, you know, a one-person hostile work environment, the guy may not be able to be trusted with classified material. You cannot be a UN ambassador and not be trusted with classified material, period.
Yeah, because it shows that you have a fundamental disrespect for everybody.
Absolutely.
Which is this guy's big problem.
Yeah.
Also, the Pentagon confirms... too much, a week or so, not even a week or so, less than 2 weeks after this Newsweek debacle where they tried to blame the world's problems on a magazine releasing information about abuse to the Quran that had been out there for 2 years, the Pentagon now comes up and says, all right, we're confirming there was Quran abuse, there was at least 5 instances of intentional Quran abuse, and so Newsweek was right. Everything was right that Newsweek had to say.
Except the toilet part. The guy is still swearing up and down General J.W. Hood, who's the commander of the Guantanamo Joint Task Force. He is arguing that the flushing down the toilet part, which is really nitpicking as far as I'm concerned, that didn't in fact happen.
I mean, well, that's fine, but it's just like their attempt to demonize a media source that actually was doing some good reporting. It was not Newsweek's fault that their source waffled. You know, whether or not the Quran was flushed down the toilet or not, it's clear that there was institutional disrespect for the Holy Book as a means of torturing prisoners allowed by the Pentagon.
Absolutely. And Thomas Friedman has a very interesting op-ed in today's New York Times that kind of sums all of this up. And it can be summed up in 2 words, Mark Maron.
Yes.
Close it.
Yeah.
You're talking about Guantanamo.
Yeah.
Close it down. It is dirty. It is toxic. It has sullied America's reputation around the world. Close it now.
Well, actually, you know, Donald Rumsfeld has a different opinion about this stuff. He sees that the real problem is letting this information get out in the world.
Yeah.
Quote, we'll need to develop considerably more sophisticated ways of using these new means of communications that are now available to reach the many and diverse audiences. We need to figure out a way to stop the truth from getting out, people around the planet, because that's what's holding us back. The truth, it's just too easy to get with the Internet.
Yeah. It's, you know.
What an idiot.
Why is he still in this job?
I have no idea, dude. I have no idea. I want to listen to our Morning Sedition radio theater if we could, and sure. then talk about some more news after that. Coming up next, 16 past the hour, Air America Radio. Happy Friday.
Hi, this is Terry Jones from Monty Python. And if you're like me, you're tired of having geeks and dorks repeat things you said 30 years ago back to you as if you don't remember saying them and then laughing as if they think they're so damn clever. I mean, wow, you memorized a 30-year-old movie? Oh, good show, old chap. Oh, great. Be president of the United States. Come on. And now for something completely different. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Sedition Radio Theater Company players bring you their production of Mark Maron and the Temple of Doom.
In his last adventure, Detective Mark Maron exposed the shadow government. But as punishment, he's been blackballed ever since by all the major clients in town. As we join him now, he's been reduced to taking the lowest detective job in Washington, D.C. Bodyguard for Jeff Gannon.
Okay, Maron. Stay three steps behind me as I walk down the supermarket aisle buying peas. You must learn discipline, slave.
Stop calling me that. You're creeping me out.
Tagging after Jeff Gannon and guarding him from vengeful reporters. I couldn't have felt more humiliated if they'd stuck me on the cover of Star in my underwear. My luck was worse than Bush's choice for UN ambassador. That's when a priest approached me near the lettuce bin.
Excuse me, lad, but are you a private detective of some sort?
Mark Maron. Private eye, Father.
Ah, brilliant. Well, I know someone who's interested in utilizing your services, but perchance you'd have to be willing.
Come here, slave, and sniff this melon.
Any job would be fine. I'm ready now.
We'll be in touch.
Another bum lead. I followed Gannon as he made the clerks uncomfortable and then followed him out to the underground parking lot. Suddenly, a man stepped out of the shadows wearing a trench coat. Without saying a word, he pulled a heater. Next thing I knew... Holy cow. Was I dead? I seemed to be floating above the parking lot. I could see my body lying in a pool of blood. Jeff Gannon was picking up some guy in a Range Rover. Then I headed towards a white light. And at the center sat a bright figure on a fiery throne. Could this be God? And then I heard music. Celestial music.
Wow, that is wild, wild stuff, Mark Maron. So you've been working for Jeff Gannon. I did not know that.
Johnny Carson? You're God?
This is just one of my countless gigs. The earliest one I can remember is Steve Allen. And for a short time in the 70s, I was the lead singer in Santana. I went completely unnoticed. But let's get down to business. Mark, the word on the street is you're available for a job.
That's what the priest was about?
You are good. Mark, I've got a little problem. I need you to find the Antichrist.
Jesus Christ?
Yes?
Oh, sorry, Jesus. I didn't mean you. I meant, holy crap!
Careful with the language, son.
Sorry, God.
Now I'm going to send you back down to Earth. I think you should start with investigating those religious right nuts that have been causing me so much trouble. I'm sick of those brain-dead hillbillies, seeing they represent me. Now beat it and see what you can come up with.
But what do you need my help? Don't you know everything?
You ask a lot of questions, but I guess that comes with the territory if you're a private dick. I've had a lot on my mind for the last few years. That's probably why I lost track of the Antichrist in the first place. I thought he was in the front yard, but that just turned out to be Buddy Hackett in a sundress roasting marshmallows on Willard Scott. Willard Scott.
Ha! But that line doesn't even make sense.
Willard Scott. The ways of the Lord are mysterious. Or maybe it's just the way I delivered it. Anyway, good luck back on Earth.
Next thing I knew, I jolted awake on an operating table.
Clear! Oh, my God. I'm alive.
You're lucky, son. All three bullets missed every vital organ. There's just one complication. How are you going to pay for all this medical care?
Don't worry. I've got a special client who's going to be taking care of things from now on.
Special client. Yeah, that's funny. Listen, if you can't pay your bill, you're going to have to leave your shoes.
Where will Mark look for the Antichrist? How will he overcome the legions of evil minions who will try to stop him? And why does Jesus talk like that? Find out next week when we hear Jesus say,
"May I help you?"
That's next week on Mark Maron and the Temple of Doom. And tune in later for the Morning Sedition radio theater production of News Daddy. When we last left News Daddy, he had taken a bullet meant for Private Eye Mark Maron. We take you now to New York General Hospital, where doctors are holding an impromptu press conference.
Since News Daddy was admitted just a few short weeks ago, he's received thousands of phone calls, cards, telegrams, emails, X-rated photographs, and pairs of panties.
I love you, News Daddy.
We are happy to report that News Daddy or Mr. Gilman's condition has not gotten any worse. He is stable. But unfortunately, he is still in a coma.
Dr. Mr. Gilman is starting to respond. They need you in critical care.
Meanwhile, in News Daddy's hospital room.
Don't die, News Daddy.
He can't hear you. He's in a coma.
I know that. Mind your own damn business. Doctor, look at the monitor. He's beginning to respond.
Give me 10 cc's of adrenaline sulfate, nurse.
And I'll have a Courvoisier and your phone number, baby. Or should I just call you Nurse Foxy?
It's a miracle. News Daddy, you're...
I'm... Wayne Gilman.
That's coming up later on Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
26 past the hour, Mark Maron here. That's Mark Riley.
Yo.
You are listening to Morning Sedition here on Air America. It's Mark and Mark here with you on Friday morning. The Memorial Day weekend is upon us. And I know people are excited. I'm excited. But I'm not driving anywhere. I'm not paying $2.15 a gallon. Which is, you know, 15 cents higher than a year ago. Thank you, George Bush and friends in the oil world.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you very much for that.
Bandar.
But also, you know, don't feel ashamed to sit at home because there's some facts about oil, about the peak oil, which is, you know, this point at which there's no return, that we've hit, what do you call it, that we're running out.
Peak oil.
That, you know, that we're on the other side of it. We're depleting all of the resources, and the implications of that are widespreading. I'm looking forward to talking to our guest, James Howard Kunstler, who we've talked to once before, who has written the book The Long Emergency.
Yeah.
It deals with, among other things, peak oil, the running out of resources, and what that's going to make the world look like. So you might want to listen. It's not going to bum you out. It's informational, and you know he's a pretty intense cat. So hang out for the conversation.
Stick around, you SUV drivers. This is Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey!
It's Memorial Day weekend coming up. Sorry about the gas prices. It wasn't our fault. Blame the president. $2.15 the national average a gallon. Up 15 cents from a year ago. We've been talking a little bit about the Pentagon confirming that there was Koran abuse. So it wasn't all Newsweek's fault. Imagine that, Riley. The war wasn't Newsweek's fault.
Michael Isikoff was right.
Yeah, it seems that way. Democrats forced the Senate in a, you know, they decided this. The Democrats decided a few days ago that they wouldn't filibuster unless absolutely necessary. Well, apparently yesterday it was absolutely necessary.
Yep.
They voted against cloture. Yeah? Is that how you say it?
They didn't get the 60 votes they needed.
Exactly. So they voted against a vote on Bolton. So he's going to have to wait.
Yeah.
Right? We've been talking about that. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. Tom DeLay has been a guy who worked for Tom DeLay, who was in charge of a treasurer of a political action committee formed by the by Tom DeLay.
Trimpack.
A judge ordered the guy to pay nearly $200,000 in damages because he was guilty of some corrupt campaign moneying stuff. And we'll talk a little bit about that later as well. But let me just say, as you power up your engines this Memorial Day weekend, be it in your car, your boat, your scooter, think about this. What happens when the oil runs out for everyone? And I'm not just talking about oil in your engine. I'm talking about the oil that has become a part of everything that we do, food production, farming, surgery, temperature control. What happens when there's no oil left at all? Well, I got one guy here, our guest, who has given it a considerable amount of thought. James Kunstler is the author of The Long Emergency, Surviving the Converging Catastrophes of the 21st Century, and he joins us now. Now, you know how, James, you don't mince words, and your book is certainly not looking for a happy ending here, but there's definitely a lot of intensity into it and a lot of good information. So why don't you tell us exactly what is The Long Emergency?
The long emergency is an interval of hardship and disorder that we're liable to go through in this country when we start bumping up against the world's limited energy resources, and we're just about there.
So you mean that we're just about out of oil?
No. The trouble's going to, we're going to get into trouble not when we run out of oil, but when we head over the peak of world production and down the slippery slope of depletion. And that's when the systems that we depend upon for the tremendous complexity of modern life are going to start wobbling and, in some cases, crashing.
Now, the idea of peak oil, which means that, I just want to make sure we understand what it means for our audience. It means that we're not going to be out of oil, but we've gone down the other side. There's no longer infinite resources. We're running out.
Well, more specifically, what peak oil means is that we will reach the world production height, and we will never produce more in a given year than we do at peak. If the world produces 84 million barrels a day in 2005, in May of 2005, then some, you know, in the years to come, whatever we produce will be less every day and less every year, and so we'll be dealing with a situation of increasing scarcity and diminishing resources. And you know, 3%, 5% a year doesn't seem like much, but in 20 years, what it really adds up to cumulatively is that you'll be producing half the oil that you were 20 years earlier.
Right.
And you saw that in the United States. The United States peaked in 1970.
Oh,
we were producing 10 million barrels a day in 1970 of conventional crude.
Right.
We are now producing 5 million barrels a day. Now, Americans don't particularly feel that much because we've been making up for it with imports.
Mm.
But, you know, guess what? Most of the remaining oil in the world is in the Middle East and in countries where the people don't like us very much, and we're desperately addicted and dependent on that resource that they have. And bear in mind also that we're going to continue to deplete at a substantial fraction every year. We're producing 5 million barrels a day now. You know, in a few years, it'll be quite a bit less than that, and so on. So this is a cumulative problem that gets actually worse and worse every year.
We've heard people talk about difficult times ahead in the past, and Americans, in many instances, seem to take the attitude, well, we'll figure something out further down the road. Your book essentially says, though, there's really nothing to figure out here. There's no alternative to fossil fuels that can be ramped up in time to meet this need.
Well, there's no question that people are resilient and that human ingenuity is for real. You know, we've demonstrated that in history. It wasn't quite the point I'm making in my book, which is that no combination of alternative fuels or systems for using them is going to allow us to keep running the United States the way we've been used to running it, or even a substantial fraction of it.
What will be the first manifestation that people will feel in this country of the long emergency?
I think we're already seeing it. One is the geopolitical struggle for the remaining oil in the world, which two-thirds of it happens to be in the Middle East. And, you know, all the friction that will arise out of that, we've only begun to see the beginning of that. The wobbling markets, mainly oil markets and financial markets.
Now, as this oil supply continues to decline, it would seem as though, like with any other product that's in demand, there's going to be some competition for procuring it. China, obviously, is the biggest country in the world population-wise, and they are ramping up their manufacturing sector and their industries. How do you see a competition between the United States and China for this ever-depleting resource? Who wins?
Well, that's a very good question, Mark, and one that we're not really paying a whole lot of attention to in the public. I think we have to remember that the Chinese can walk into some of these areas in the Eastern Hemisphere where most of the oil is. We can't. As a military issue, you have to wonder, is America going to contest in a land war with China 12,000 miles away in the deserts of Central Asia? That's not a project that we can feel very confident about. The question of how much we conflict with China over oil depends to some degree on how desperately Americans, the public and their leaders, struggle to sustain the unsustainable, namely the drive-in utopia of the suburban American dream way of life, which is clearly unsustainable. If we, you know, one of the things that we are heading into is the possibility that there will be a desperate fight to maintain the entitlements of this way of life, you know, which after all have a kind of iconic role in our collective imagination. And that fight will be an act of futility, but it may sap a lot of our national psychological and economic energy and political energy in the process. So that's a problematical thing.
Now, are there other countries, other developed countries, that are better suited to weathering this long emergency than we are?
Everybody's going to have a very hard time in the the modern advanced industrial world. But there are some things you can that are fairly self-evident when you look at other places. Europe, for example. Europe did not destroy its towns and its cities, especially its small towns. Europe did not destroy its public transportation. We did. And we destroyed our towns and cities, for the most part. You know, you go to places like Kansas City and St. Louis today, you know, they're empty in the center. For all practical purposes, they barely exist. Perhaps most importantly, the Europeans did not destroy local agriculture and the activities associated with it, what are called the value-added activities of making things out of the products. We did. And we now rely on the Archer Daniels Midland cheese doodle and Pepsi model of agriculture, which is going to be a tremendous problem for us in this long emergency that I'm describing. We're going to have to grow more of our food closer to home. Industrial agriculture, as we've known it for the last half century, using these massive, quote, inputs of oil and fertilizers made out of natural gas, is going to be a thing of the past. It's going to be a very sharp break from what we're used to. People are going to suffer in this country. It's going to require a completely new way of understanding how we value the land and what it's used for and where people are going to live.
I want to give you the opportunity, because I've talked to you once before on the phone we have here at the show. If this isn't negative, if this isn't pessimistic, if there is a way to look at this as something not necessarily to look forward to, but some reevaluation and reinvention of what it is to be human, I want to hear it.
Oh, well, I think that we're definitely headed in that direction. This long emergency is going to compel us to live differently, and mainly to downscale all the activities in American life. And to some extent, that's going to mean a return to a much more community-based way of living, and to networks of economic interdependence that have been destroyed by things like the corporate colonialism of Walmart. You know, which, by the way, is something that Americans greeted with open arms, you know, for 30 years. They wanted that to happen, and they've sort of gotten what they've asked for. But that's going to be over with. You know, everything big and huge and giant and international scale in our life is going to have to become smaller. And that's going to have a lot of beneficial consequences for us in America. We're going to really return to a significant kind of community life where people fill social and economic roles and enjoy a lot of social enactments that we have left behind for virtual things like television and the internet.
It seems optimistic given what you're laying out to me. Given that the fact that, you know, we are on the verge of what seems to be almost a crusade on behalf of certain factions of this country on a religious level, mm-hmm. in terms of what the conservative administrations in the past have put into place to protect the free market system, it seems to me that, you know, the assumption you're making is that, you know, this catharsis will be enough to kind of, you know, shock those forces out of play as well, and I don't know how that's possible.
Well, I think some of those forces will simply lose traction. When I say that everything big is going to suffer and wither, I include government. You know, a lot of my friends are very upset and paranoid about big government and Big Brother and George Bush turning into a tyrannical kind of avatar of a tyrannical kind of society. And I actually see it differently. I think that what you'll see is that the national government and even the state governments will become more and more ineffective and impotent. And, in fact, they'll be lucky if they can answer the phones, let alone regulate our laws. But I don't rule out quite a bit of disorder and turbulence as a new society self-organizes and emerges from this long emergency. But I do maintain that at the national level, they're going to have the national level, anything large, any big government is really going to have trouble controlling things because, as much as anything else, they are a manifestation of 100-plus years of ultra-cheap energy.
We're going to return to sort of an agrarian lifestyle?
I would put it a little differently. I'd say that agriculture is going to return much more to the center of American economic life than we've understood it to be for our lifetimes, and probably is going to require a great deal more human labor.
So on a local level, on a community level, you're saying that there's just not, we cannot cover the amount of distance we once covered, certainly in terms of traveling, and also we cannot run the machines that are that we have put into place for the agriculture industry and any other industry.
That's a fair way to put it. You could also say the age of the 3,000-mile Caesar salad is coming to an end.
That's a good way to close. James Howard Kunstler, thank you for being with us. The book is The Long Emergency. It was a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks a lot. Mark and Mark.
Back to the farms. That's where we need to go. That's what's going to happen. We'll be right back. No, we're not going anywhere. We'll be sitting here, and you'll be here with us, and we're going to have Riley's Dog of the Week momentarily.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil. In 3 hours or less, Air America Radio.
Back the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
Morning's edition on the Air America Radio Network. How do you like that? The Air America Radio Network. So is this true, Riley? You're going to be on the road to City Hall here on New York One tonight at 7:30 p.m.?
Tonight at 7:30 p.m., the Reporters Roundtable.
Holy crap! Riley's a TV star.
No, I'm not.
I can't even give it away on television these days. You know, here's what I got. I got a request to do a call-in to a radio, a television show, as they had the picture of Saddam in his underwear. They wanted me to call up, put my picture beside it, and make some comments.
Really?
I decided against
it. Your picture in your underwear?
No, oh, no. Then I get this piece of mail that somebody wrote. Where the hell is that?
Oh, here it is.
Someone actually wrote this in a letter. Actually wrote it. Mark, you're offended at pictures of Saddam and his BVDs? You're kidding. He's a rotten bastard who needs to be flogged. Yeah, that's not the issue. The issue was I would be embarrassed if I was in my underwear on the cover of this. All right. Okay. Well, you know, also I want to announce that we will be broadcasting from the City Bakery, my friend. Next Friday, June 3rd, City Bakery here in New York City on 18th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues from 6 to 9 a.m. Come down. We'll have some free stuff. I heard we talked to one of our guys downtown. There's going to be some free stuff.
Free stuff?
Yeah, I hope it's going to be ready.
Somebody needs to call and make sure they don't deliver here on the day we're down there.
Okay, and later in the show, we're going to be joined by actor Joe Pantoliano, or Joey Pants, as some people know. You know him from The Sopranos. And we're going to be giving away 5 pairs of tickets to his screening of his new film, which is tonight, I believe, right? Tomorrow night.
Second best.
He's going to be at the early show screening to answer questions with the director. Here we go. You know what time it is, Riley? It's time for... Mark Riley's Dog of the Week.
This week's dog, Mark, just sort of jumped out at us because it sounded so unbelievably petty and xenophobic. It involves the mother of a young man who made the ultimate sacrifice for his country. 27-year-old Army Staff Sergeant Anthony Lagman was killed in Afghanistan last year. You may not know this, but there's an organization called the Gold Star Mothers who allegedly represent women whose sons paid the ultimate price. Yet Anthony Lagman's mother was denied membership in the organization. The reason? Lajaya Lagman, a Filipino, isn't a citizen. Not that she's here illegally. The Westchester County, New York woman has lived here and paid taxes for better than 20 years. The national president of the Gold Star Mothers says there's nothing the organization can do. Then Ann Heard delivered a slap in the face to all those who have served their country. She said, quoting here, "We can't go changing the rules every time the wind blows," unquote. That one got the veterans who sponsored Legia Lagman's application to the Gold Star Mothers quite a bit upset. It also angered several elected officials, including Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton from right here in New York. And why not? Even two former presidents of the Gold Star Mothers say this policy is wrong. Mm. Anthony Lagman was a citizen and a soldier. The fact that his mother isn't a citizen has nothing whatsoever to do with his sacrifice. It should have nothing to do with her membership in the Gold Star Mothers, who should be proud to have her. Ann Heard and Gold Star Mothers, you are the Morning Sedition Dog of the Week.
Yes, good one. And as I said before, Mark Riley will be on the road to City Hall on New York One tonight, 7:30 p.m. Watch it.
Hey.
Watch it, my friend. You were on MSNBC a few
days
ago.
Week, yeah.
You want to talk about the Charlie Horse incident? you want to talk about it?
All right, yeah, I'll talk about it. Well, wait a minute. Don't you have something to do?
Oh, no. Look at that. That's hilarious. I'm not going to get into that. We have been talking a little bit about the Pentagon's announcement that they are confirming the fact that the Koran was abused, along with, obviously, many individuals. But Newsweek was right. The attempt to blame the entire Guantanamo Bay, Afghanistan, prison torture rap on Newsweek did not stick. Tom DeLay, a little scared today, I'm sure, because one of the treasurer of a political action committee formed by Tom DeLay has just been nailed.
200 large.
State District Judge Joe Hart in Texas, I guess, decided that this guy, $200,000. We'll get into that a little more. But DeLay's more pissed off about a joke made on Law and Order.
Yeah. There you go. That is what he needs to be concentrating on.
You guys are just whiny. Like, you know, I mean, after a certain point, it's like, shut up.
Hey,
it's
man,
a TV show.
They got nothing to do. I'm not even going to mention Paris Hilton.
Two days after, they said they were only going to filibuster, and if they absolutely had to, the Democrats filibustered, and now they put off the John Bolton nomination.
Till June!
Good. Yeah. Guy's a bastard. We're going to talk about the Dream Diary.
The Dream Diary.
Going to get into this Tom DeLay stuff.
And Joey Pants.
Conversation continues, my friends.
Next on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition. Fighting treason with a reason. This is Air America Radio.
Six past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning's Edition here on Air America Radio. Mark and Mark.
Yo.
In the morning on Air America Radio, my friends. Come see us in person. We'll be broadcasting live next Friday, June 3rd, from City Bakery in New York City on 18th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues from 6 to 9 a.m. Come see the magic.
Yeah.
Come touch Mark and Mark.
That's right. Have a croissant on Maron.
Hey, wait a minute. Am I paying? I thought you were paying. Somebody's paying.
Somebody's paying.
If you guys get there early enough, we're going to give you some free stuff. I heard we got new free stuff in the works.
Swag, baby!
Yes, I heard some new swag. Hey, watch TV tonight, because you can see Riley on Road to City Hall, New York One, tonight at 7:30.
Yeah.
How do you like that?
Yeah.
A little later in the program, not even much later, we're going to be joined by actor Joe Pantoliano. Joe Pants, as some people call him. You've seen him in Midnight Run, the Matrix movies, The Sopranos, of course. We're going to give away a few tickets, five pairs of tickets, to a screening of his new film, Second Best. We've also been talking about the Pentagon is now confirming a few cases, five to be exact, of Koran mistreatment. Newsweek was right, folks. The spin didn't take. They may not have been exactly right about the toilet one, but let's just assume that, you know, they might have been right, and that the source waffled on them. But this is a failure of the Bush administration's attempt to blame the entire torture scenario on Newsweek magazine.
Shut that rascal down.
Democrats forced the Senate to delay on Bolton, to delay the vote of confirmation on Bolton. Not surprising, but I like that the Democrats got some nads going there, man.
Yeah, you know, the people weren't sure if the Democrats were going to let this sail through. And initially, remember, when they first, when his name first came up, no problem, smooth sailing.
Yep.
That was months ago.
Yep. Well, they decided it was time to filibuster. You know, two days after they said, well, they only in a real necessity. Well, the necessity happened yesterday. We'll talk a little bit about Tom DeLay also later. He's mad at Law and Order, the television show. What a baby. So right now, you know what? I missed therapy yesterday because I was too strung out on cake and butter and sugar from that staff meeting. What's wrong with me? But so now I'm overburdened with dreams. Here's my dream from last night. I come home and see my dead cat Butch with a roll of duct tape pinning James Dobson to my couch. He's gagged and his eyelids are taped open. And Butch has dressed him in a sparkly red cocktail dress and a blonde wig and a tiara and what I guess you'd call hooker boots. And bright red lipstick was smeared all around his mouth. He looked like a cheap blow-up doll. I say, Butch! What have I told you about kidnapping, man? Butch lights a cigarette and says, Mark Maron, this sad little coke whore says that homosexuality can be cured. Well, let's see if it can also be taught. I said, what are you planning here, Butch? Butch says, re-education, Mark Maron. Massive re-education. He's coming out. He wants the world to know. Got to let it show. And Dobson struggled and made a little squeaking noise. Butch held a razor-sharp claw under his chin and says, yes, princess, we have quite an evening in store. Tonight, we are going to focus on my family. And in my family, Heather has two mommies. Butch waves her cigarette at me. First, Mark Maron, we need some music. Erasure, Bronski Beat, Junior Vasquez. It should all be on the turntable. Crank it. The room starts thumping. Next, we go online. First to Amazon to buy some picture books by Tom of Finland and Robert Mapplethorpe. Look at this one, Dobby. Have you ever seen a whip handle put up there before? And then it's on to eBay to buy some Fiesta ware. Then it's on to eBay to buy some Fiesta ware and a Wonder Woman cookie jar. Dobson starts whimpering. Take it easy, Mary. I haven't forgotten the DVDs. Oh, what a collection. Moulin Rouge, Midnight Cowboy, Spartacus, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, The L Word, and of course your favorite, Top Gun. Dobson grunted, made a few feeble peeping sounds. Butch stroked Dobson's temple gently. And when we're done watching these, Judy, we'll get some tapas and then maybe get a pedicure. You'll be a whole new man. Here, have an apple teeny. I woke up and my bed was filled with the Pet Shop Boys' greatest hits.
Oh, man. Junior Vasquez, I used to go to places he used to spin.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he was good, I remember right? When Junior used to hang out in the Paradise Garage.
Back in the day. So dig this. The senators are weighing, Republican senators, Brownback, Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas.
Yeah.
Decides he would, they're going to put together a resolution to apologize to the Indians.
Cheaper than paying them.
They're going to apologize to the Indians for the many instances of violence, maltreatment, and neglect inflicted on Native peoples by citizens of the United States. Now, Congress apparently rarely apologizes for anything.
For anything. Yeah. That's right. The only time they've done it before was apologizing to Hawaiians for the overthrow of the Hawaiian kingdom, which, by the way, was illegal. That was back in 1993. And then an apology to Japanese Americans who were placed in detention camps during World War II. That happened in 1988. The apology for slavery.
Didn't happen.
Hasn't happened yet. So, you know, I like this. Sam Brownback says the resolution would apologize for many instances of maltreatment, violence, and neglect. How many, Sam?
But how are you going to do that? And, you know, Republicans are, you know, they rarely have any grace with these things. I mean, these Republicans who are proposing this letter, they're just so hypocritical. They don't even realize that they're apologizing for things that they're going to go right back to doing tomorrow. This isn't a real apology. And, you know, we actually, you know, Riley, we have our guy.
Yeah.
We actually got a copy of the letter they drafted, and it really proves just, you know, how much they just don't get it. You know, let me read it. You know, and bear with me here. All right, this is just a draft, apparently. Dear Indian, sorry, we mean American Indians. How? This is horrendous. This is horrendous. I mean, the Republicans.
I quit. I'm leaving.
No, they're horrendous. I'm ashamed of the Republicans in Congress. All right, this is Congress up on the hill, many moons from where you are. And we have decided to offer a formal apology for the centuries of mistreatment and neglect visited upon you and your squaws. Hopefully you will be able to bury the hatchet and find peace without the bottle. This is tasteless.
It sure is.
For Republicans to be involved in this type of, I can't, this is just tasteless. And sorry about all your sacred sites being desecrated. You can still honor your ancestors through the asphalt. And who really...
Whoa.
Wait, we'll dig this line. And who really owns land anyway?
Oh, sure.
All right. And the bummer...
Bummer?
No, listen to this. This is horrendous stuff. And bummer about the buffalo, huh?
Oh, man.
And remember the Indian who cried when people littered? We just found out he was Italian. What a bastard. Hollywood, huh? And sorry about everyone hating Dances with Wolves, even though we all know Goodfellas clearly should have won the Oscar that year. And sorry about F Troop. Remember how stupid corporate Agarn was, though? That was funny and generous. Also, Custard was a bit of a douchebag, don't you think? You showed him. Remember the Lone Ranger? He was nice, Tonto and all. This is awful. They're going to have to redo this because you got to get some Democrats involved in this. Well, there's more. And no offense, but we've heard from actual Indians that Pocahontas was a bit of a whore.
Oh,
no.
I'm just reading. This comes from the Republicans. And sorry we've named all those crappy sports teams after you. But how about those Braves? This is on the letter.
He's got Redskins tickets, I'm sure.
And we think you should feel lucky to have reservations. Do you know how hard it is to get one at the Capitol Grill on Thursday night? Just trying to lighten the mood. No, it just said this. I'm not doing it.
That does it. I'm calling my agent.
Next time we're at your casinos, we'll bet all of our wampum on red. You can count on that. There's iron in our words. Please accept these blankets along with our apology. Sincerely, the Republicans in Congress.
Oh, my God. How about the iron in their heads?
Dude, I mean, I cannot believe the pure tastelessness and evil of that draft. I certainly hope they correct that. Maybe some Democrats can get involved, or at least some people that care.
Evil?
Yeah.
Evil?
Just awful. Ooh. Just awful. So Joe Pantoliano, is going to be with us momentarily. You know him from The Sopranos. You know him from Midnight Run. You know him from Richard Business, from The Matrix, from Memento.
Yes, Memento.
That was a hell of a movie. He's going to be with us as we continue this Friday morning here on Morning Sedition.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Nineteen past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yo!
It's Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. In just a few minutes, we're going to be giving away tickets to a screening of the new movie Second Best. It's playing at the Angelica here in New York City. This is from the trailer to the movie.
Once upon a time, the loser had a big job in publishing in the city across the river. Things didn't work out, so now he sticks to home base, County of Bergen. Selling suits and self-publishing a weekly diatribe on the evils of self-delusion.
Right now, we've got the star of the film in the studio. You recognize that voice. You may know him as Joey Pants. You may have seen him in The Matrix, Midnight Run, The Fugitive, Risky Business, Memento, and, of course, The Sopranos. Joe Pantoliano, we're happy you're here.
Thank you, Mark.
Yeah. Yes. I watched most of the movie, Second Best. And it seems like obviously it's a much smaller film than you're used to doing. It's heavy, man. I mean, it's funny, but it's very dark. Can you tell us a little bit about how it came about, what it's about?
Yeah, you know, when I was working on season 3, which was my first year on The Sopranos, my lawyer, who was an executive producer on this, Paul Mayerson, brought me the script. And, you know, the problem with American culture these days is everybody wants to make a sure buck movie. They make these recipes for disaster. They don't have an original thought in their mind.
Yeah.
They surround themselves with actors that make sense, that's going to, you know, hedge their bets. So if they make a bad movie, they'll be able to sell in the foreign market. So essentially, they wind up making a bad movie. So you're reading the paper, and everybody, all these powers that be, talking about how the receipts are down, and nobody's going to the movies because receipts are down, and we don't know why it's 20% down. Well, the reason why it's 20% down is the movies suck.
Yeah.
Nobody's watching nobody wants to go, and the word of mouth gets you. So all they're designing these movies for an opening weekend.
Yeah.
If they can get that weekend,
then they can sell it off in the farm marketplace and in DVD
sales.
They
don't lose nothing.
Yeah, it's a hedge fund, but it's not. It's art and commerce, and commerce is overtaking the art aspect of movie making.
Absolutely.
So Eric Weber, who wrote and directed Second Best, I met him. He's not a young man. You know, he's a guy my age. You know, I'm in middle 50s. Maybe he's got a couple of years on me. He's passionate about it. He financed this movie with his own money. There's a thing called below, a Screen Actors Guild has a division where it's, they give you a break, and so do the other unions. We shot this movie entirely in New Jersey. It was a union movie. The unions gave us a break. We shot it in 24 days, 25 days. A lot of my friends, I'm a producer on the movie, so I reached out and I called my friends to be in this movie. The only reason why this movie was made is because studios wouldn't, they said, who's going to want to look at a movie about a bunch of old guys that can't get laid? You know, so this is a story about the idea that in our culture, you have to be number one. And so when you are, if you're lucky enough to be number one, then you have to deal with the frustrating, frightening aspect that you will not be able to sustain that number one position. We will never always be number one. And the majority of this culture, we're all second besters. And what Eric Weber is trying to say is it's okay to embrace your second bestness.
In the film, though, it's not just second best. I mean, you embrace a type of bitterness that I think a lot of people are familiar with. You know, very frankly, very matter-of-factly, you're not, the character that you play is a writer who's not afraid to, you know, insult just about everybody around him in order to get this point across. And there's a...
Well, I think that's why Eric cast me.
Yeah. No, you're great in it. And it's also, it's interesting because it's shot on video, which is, you know, it takes you a second to even see you on video, to see Bronson Pinchot on video. It's because it's a quality of film that's it's very it's inexpensive, and it took a minute to adjust to, but because of the video, there's a rawness to it that really comes through.
Yeah, it almost feels like it's documentary, like you're peeking into the style. I actually saw my friend Peter Markle did the John McCain movie, Sins of the Father. I saw it last night at the Intrepid. And they shot it. Now, we shot that movie two summers ago with Canon digital cameras. And the technology is the future. You know, if I can give anybody any kind of advice, is sell your Kodak stock, because it's going to all be digital. And the quality...
I'm writing that down.
Yeah.
So cool.
The quality is going to get better. When we did our movie... You know, I always said as the producing part of the entity to Eric is that we need to embrace our limitations. We have to tell this story. The content is important. What you're writing is so important. We surround the infrastructure of your story and what you're telling with great actors.
Patricia Hearst is in it.
And Patty's a friend of mine, a neighbor, and I asked her to come in, and she came in and met Eric and said yes. And Jennifer, you know, basically came in and created that character, Carol.
Jennifer Tilly.
Yeah. Jennifer Tilly plays a crossing guard who's married, who I have an affair with, because, you know...
You get laid in the movie.
Yeah. I have a love scene.
Uh-oh.
And I'll tell you, because it's on video, which, you know, is what all porn used to be on,
mm-hmm.
It definitely resonates.
Well, thank you. You know, it's the pornographic qualities of this movie are fascinating. And also, you know, it reaches out to
bitter people.
Well, people, but I also think that it touches a part of us.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, that Elliot is saying what most people think.
Yeah, I actually think that's the appeal of the movie. And, you know, why don't we give some screening passes away right now? If you're listening in the New York area, you can call us here for a pair of tickets to tomorrow's 7:30 showing of Second Best at the Angelica Theater here in Manhattan. The phones are now open, 866-303-2270. The first five callers, I guess, we will win the tickets. 866-303-2270. I saw the movie the other day. I watched it on a DVD at home. I'll tell you, it's an interesting movie. It's not necessarily an upbeat movie, but it's definitely an honest movie, and it reveals a part all I could say from my point of view. It's definitely a male-oriented movie, but boy, the type of bitterness that and the type of disappointment in a comedic way. It's an interesting film. We're going to talk more with Joe Pantoliano Toronto about the movie, you know, in just a few minutes. So 866-303-2270. First five callers are going to win the tickets, and we'll announce your names in just a few minutes. It's 27 past the hour. It's Air America Radio.
Call us at 866.
Ha! That's awesome. Go on.
303.
Wow. Yes. Yes. I love it.
2270.
Oh, yeah. Drop the bomb. Drop it. There's not a dry eye in the house. Keep going.
That's 866-303-2270.
Okay. Well, just so you know, it was good, but I was also being pretty generous.
This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
It's Morning's Edition here on Air America Radio. I want to congratulate Maris, Tom, Joe, Rob, and John. They all won a pair of tickets to see Second Best tomorrow night at the Angelica. We're talking to the star of Second Best, also the star of many things. You might know him from Midnight Run, from The Sopranos, from Risky Business. But Joe Pantoliano today is the star of Second Best. And, you know, Joe, you play a pretty selfish character. And the character refuses to be self-pitying. And because of that, he's going to make everyone, you know, everyone else around him pay for it.
Miserable. And he lives off his mother, who's living in a senior citizen's home. He's living off his ex-wife, who dumped him for the contractor, architect that was building their dream house. Because he was lucky enough at least to marry a wife that's a psychiatrist, was making a buku bucks. But in the meantime, she starts banging the architect. And now I'm friends with the architect because they give me checks. I sued her for, you know, alimony. My dental hygienist son, who's just this gorgeous guy, the only son I got, and he turns out to be gay. And I'm just begging him. I'm pleading with him to just try a woman once. Just make your daddy happy. And can I have $100 because I need to buy groceries?
Yeah.
I mean, the guy, just there's no end to it. But Eric Weber's does not cheap out. You know, he does not, in the end, make this guy become a winner. He does not, you know, even allow this guy to realize really how lucky he is.
Now, Joe Pantoliano, this movie was shot in Jersey. Is it a Jersey movie? I mean, there is now, I guess a quantifiable group of movies that are generally regarded as New Jersey films or films that.
No, I wouldn't say. I mean, we shot it in New Jersey because we wanted to it was a community. We shot it in Tenafly.
I live in Englewood. So
okay, so we shot all in that surrounding area. This is more of Americana. It could be anywhere, USA.
Anywhere, yeah.
You know, and the problem is that a lot of studios or allegedly independent filmmakers will go and shoot. You know, if this movie was an independent studio picture, it would have been made in Toronto or Vancouver or Montreal, and then they would have said it was New Jersey. You know.
You know what I like about the film is, honestly, I couldn't stop watching it. I'm a big fan of yours, but the compelling thing to me was the tone of conversation. There was an honesty to these guys that was brutal. And there was parts of it that it was uncomfortable for me to watch, even though I've been sitting in the same circle of guys saying the same thing before in my life.
That might be New Jersey. That, you know, you know, I know that because I grew up in New Jersey.
Yeah.
I'm from Hoboken, New Jersey. I moved when I was 14 to Cliffside Park, New Jersey. I went to high school there. And I know that, you know, when we rag on each other, my friends are like, you know, just tearing me apart.
Yeah.
I really feel that at the worst, when they really get under my skin, it really is an expression of love. The other thing about Eric Weber, though, that I must say is that on all of the occasions during the making of this movie where I gave up. I gave up as an actor. I gave up as a producer. I kept saying, we can't do it. We don't have the money to do this. We don't have the infrastructure to do this. Nobody's going to get it. Who's going to care? But he continued. He was relentless.
What's his history?
He was an ad guy, he advertising guy for many years. And he wrote the book, How to Pick Up Girls, that wound up becoming the movie, How to Pick Up Girls.
The one that you did in the magazines?
Yeah. The one that you started.
It was a little picture that had been around for years.
Yeah, he sold it in Playboy.
Wound up selling
4 million copies of this thing. So he has really a young artistic spirit. When he said, we're going to enter it for consideration for the Sundance Film Festival, I screamed at him. I said, what are you, crazy, this movie, you'll never get into Sundance. They got into Sundance. You know, I said, are you crazy? None of these kids are going to come and see this movie at Sundance. It sold out crowds, and they had to add 3 screens.
Hey.
You know, and then, you know, Think Film took us on, bought the film. We are in one theater. People have to understand that this Memorial Day weekend, where all of the big movies are coming out, we're like this little David against the Goliaths. We got one theater. We have one screen at the Angelica.
That's it? One?
That's it. That's it. You know, we got this great review in the New York Times. Jeffrey Lyons gave us a rave. I mean, we're getting really great reviews. It appeals to a older demographic. So, of course, all these geniuses, you know, these yuppies, these spankies, these guys that are running my life are going, well, you know, it's not going to be 18 or 49. Nobody's going to want to watch this movie. And the fact is that more and more people, they see it. It strikes a chord.
Well, it got under my skin, and I'm not an old guy. I'm 41. But I think a lot of the reason is people are going to want to see you. You're sitting right here. You're no different than you are on screen. I feel like I know you just because I've seen you in films for 15 years or 20 years. I mean, my assumption was that people just know you to be Joe, not the guy in The Sopranos. Is that true or not?
That is true. But also, it's the demographic. Two brothers came out, when I was coming out of the car just now, came up to me, and one guy said, hey, he said, Captain Howard, how you doing, man? And I says, I'm great. And he was with a friend of his, and he's going, well, how do you help people? And I'm looking at this kid, and his friend is going, what the hell are you talking about? And finally, we figured out that he thought I was Dr. Phil. You know, it's like, so, you know, but if it's, you know,
those people are idiots.
You're the Memento demographic. You're the Matrix group. You're the Soprano group. And it's always about those characters. You know,
I forgot about Memento. That's a good
yeah.
movie.
Yeah.
Now, you obviously bring a passion to your work, and you're very passionate about Second Best. What does it take to get you passionate?
The fact that I don't put the script down. Doesn't matter if it's a large screen movie, you know, if it's Daredevil or if it's Bad Boys or if it's Second Best or if it's the Memento. Once it's made, the fact that if it turns out any good at all is always a miracle. What happens in the editing is always a miracle. And I love the idea of being on the, I love the cutting edge stuff. When we did The Matrix, that was like groundbreaking, you know. Michael Bay, when we did Bad Boys, he was a first timer that I wanted to work with. I've had great successes with first time directors. Taylor Hackford, Andy Davis, you know, Michael Bay, Chris Nolan, the Wachowski brothers, you know, the first movie I did with them was Bound. That was, you know, it's for my money, probably my favorite movie I've done with them, and I've done Bound and The Matrix. But you know, the limitations of the dollar value and what they were able to say and how they used that camera was fascinating. So that stuff is a big indicator for me. And it's you know, used to be you got to take 70% of the work that I would take was to pay the rent and you know, get the mortgage and now. You know, that I have a little bit more latitude in my choices.
Wait a minute. You made a good choice with this one, man. Second Best is the movie. It's playing at the Angelica in New York City, you know, with hopes of a wider release soon. Now, tonight you're going to be doing a Q&A after the 7:30 showing?
Yeah. And Polly Draper's going to be there, and Matthew Arkin and Eric Weber, the writer-director, myself.
Thanks for joining us, Joe Pantoliano. It was great seeing you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me on, fellas.
Coming up, we've got your weekly warning about the end times. Rapture Watch on the way, 42 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Y'all ready for this?
Hi, this is Charles Barkley, and you listen to Marc Maron and Mark Riley. Anything less will be uncivilized. is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here, Mark Riley.
Yes.
Quite a show it's been here on Morning Sedition, Air America Radio. If you want to come see us in person, we'll be broadcasting live next Friday, June 3rd, from City Bakery here in New York City.
Yeah.
On 18th Street between 5th and 6th. You can come on down, get some free stuff, have some coffee, meet Mark and Mark. Well, I just referred to myself in the third person, didn't
there
I?
There you go.
Hey, me. Hey, have a good weekend with gas prices at $2.15 average across America. Down from 9 cents about a month ago, but still 15 cents higher than a year ago. And when in doubt, blame Bush.
That's right.
What I say. Blame Bush. Hey, where else are we going with this? The Bible's Book of Revelations. Oh, did I mention Morgan Spurlock, the creator and the man behind the documentary Supersize Me, is going to be here in just
a few. He's
going
to be here?
Yeah. But now, more importantly, the Book of Revelations portends the end of days and the second coming, the Christian Messiah, one of our president's favorite stories. Though no one knows when the end times will come, there are signs that will appear to men. Here on Morning Sedition, we won't let you be caught off guard by the end of the world. That's why we present this week's Rapture Watch with MILF Cardinal Milfington of the recently disgraced Diocese of Denton, Texas. Your grace?
Wake up, sinners, from the slumbers of Satan. Your dreams have become sanctuaries for fornicating hunchbacks. Your wishes the candy-filled bowels of a Mihilek. And your bed a resting place for the skanky cast-offs of Ryan Seacrest, son of Samizar.
Oh, yeah.
The time has come for your judgment, American idolators. Only you won't get into heaven by boinking a chubby dancer with a pill problem. You'll just have to do it the Carrie Underwood way with mind-numbing mediocrity. The end times approacheth it once again, and yay! We have been teased with the promise of world destruction so many times before, only to be let down. So I feel your frustration, but this time I'm pretty sure about it. Well, the dark indoctrinators of the Mideast have crossed that line of no return. They have committed a trespass so heinous it almost rivals the one committed by those people who finally got public access to the beach in front of David Geffen's Malibu estate. Christ never frolicked in the surf, people. Remember that the next time you wake up and find your boogie board super glued to your chest. Damn, kids. Tribulations is nigh. For according to the Saudi Institute, a dissident pro-human rights monitoring agency that I would normally never pay attention to, it is the official policy of Saudi Arabia's government to burn, shred, or dump Bibles, crosses, and other Christian paraphernalia. Kantiki Modasa Walla Walla Big Bang! Blasphemy, desarcation. And even worse, I bet they recycle the stuff. I didn't even know these people had Bibles. What will they soil next? Robert Tilton prayer cloths? Salt and mud stains in the questionable shape of the Virgin Mary on the side of a freeway? My prized reliquary containing Christ's left nard? Nard!
Wow.
I don't even have a revelation to quote from them that relates to this, Mark, and I bet it's because they burned that, too.
Oh, man.
Whoa.
Imagine the arrogance of a country that would desecrate a divine book revered by millions of gullible, poorly educated people around the world. It just makes me so upset.
Man, are you all right there, Cardinal?
I'll be fine. You got any tissues?
We're actually out.
No problem. Just hand me that copy of the Holy Quran.
No, Cardinal! What are you doing? Oh, my God! Oh, my God!
Oh, yes. That's good.
Oh, no.
Hey, calm down, Mark. You know,
wow.
I can't show a little emotion every once in a while. You're a very cold man, Marin.
You're insane. Do you know what you're doing? I mean, where'd a guy like you even get a book like that anyway?
Military surplus, Mark. All sorts of neat stuff at your local military liquidation sale. Indian artifacts, old treaties, imitation biological weapons labs.
Lee Harvey Oswald's assassination orders. It's all there.
You don't even see the slightest bit of hypocrisy in what you just did, Cardinal.
Okay, Mark. Guess what? We're gonna play the quiet game now.
What's the quiet game, Cardinal?
Yeah, you lose.
Oh.
Okay, take that. Pop scripture test. Thessalonians 5, Matthew 3, Stinky chapters 4-8, Ringo 9. Which one's real?
Time's up.
And by time, I mean time, ye heathenites, all time. There's no getting over this one. Jesus does not like burning people's Bibles, except for the Book of Mormon. That thing's just an embarrassment. So take care, ye sons and daughters of Zelophehad, for soon you'll all be in hell with your friends, and I'll be spending an eternity with Pat Robertson.
Jeez, what the hell am I saying?
I don't even know.
Until then, fornicators, fake capers and caters, keep on fornicating. Und wir haben das Licht an für Sie in der Hölle.
What? Oh, man. German gives me the creepies.
Yeah, really.
What is that, Cardinal? What's the German thing at the end there?
You got to reach all sorts of cultures, all sorts of people.
Yeah, I guess I shouldn't be too hard on the German language.
No.
You know, I mean, a lot of people speak the German language. It's just a little harsh, isn't it? A little harsh.
German language is very beautiful.
Really?
Are you sure you're a cardinal? Are you sure?
Yeah, I know that. From the tip of my toes to the top of my head, fella.
That's what I was afraid of.
Are you going to come with us next week when we're down at City Bakery on Friday? I think you are. You're going to come down. You're going to meet us down there, right? That means everybody.
I'll be down there blessing the scones.
We're going to be there on June 3rd.
How about the
doing the show live?
They need blessing. Have you seen those things?
You know, people are going to come down. They're going to want to meet you, Cardinal. So yeah. I think you're going to have to wear the outfit, aren't you?
The habit. The Cardinals have it.
I'm not putting on your dress again, Mary.
I think someone's got to get a costume for next Friday, aren't we?
Yeah.
You don't let down the people, do you, Cardinal?
Come on, there's a couple of those robe stores near you, aren't there?
Well, just as long as you dress up in your Jerusalem complex outfit.
Syndrome, pal. Syndrome.
Syndrome. Whatever.
Yeah, you can get that book for a nickel on Amazon now. If you want to get...
I don't want to go to that trouble.
I'll tell you what, I think I might have 700 downstairs if you want me to give you one.
I think there was a homeless guy using it as a shelter.
Just that book or 90
whole
of them?
Stack of them.
No, they're actually very hard to come by. I think they like the last time I checked, there was only 900 used on Amazon.
I don't know, they're very hard to come by. You paid at least $30,000 for a first shipment, didn't you?
No, I didn't. I didn't pay anything. I got a little deal from a publisher, and it was a very well received book by the people that enjoyed the book. You know, only a couple of people didn't. But I'm not saying that many people bought it. Hey, look.
Your family?
Listen, Cardinal.
Yes?
Before you take any more shots at me. Yeah, that's right. Get back into character. Did you know there's an Amalgamated Bank, like, right across the street from the Strand?
Uh-oh.
From the Strand?
Oh, we're going to be at the Strand the week after. From City Bakery. There's, like, an Amalgamated Bank, like, right there.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
I love Amalgamated Bank.
I'm not... how much do you like Amalgamated Bank, Cardinal?
I love to get into the zone.
Man, that's the AutoZone, man.
Amalgamated Bank Zone.
AutoZone. We're going to try and get you. We're actually going to try and get AutoZone to sponsor the rest of the You think I'm kidding? There was an actual conversation I had yesterday with the bigwig.
That's right.
We said, you know, the Cardinal likes the AutoZone song.
The Cardinal didn't hear it, though, because he was busy slacking off outside the room where the meeting was being held.
Ah,
excuse me for taking a little free time, Mr. Riley.
You know, that's not free time.
We do have employment laws.
You ate yesterday.
Did you eat any of that cake?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. How good was that? You know, I ate, like, half of it. Like, I had an embarrassing moment where it was just me in the conference room with the cake, and people wouldn't even come into the room because they're like, oh, no, don't disturb me. He's feeding. It was sad. You don't have that problem. Look at you. You're like a thin bastard. I've got nothing on you.
I'm like
Mr. 3130.
What are you? You're like, a string bean.
I'm like a thin bastard. Is that what you're getting paid for?
Huh? To say thin bastard? What's your
problem? That's what he's well paid for.
That kind of repartee?
What is your beef? Repartee, if I didn't talk, we'd have these horrendous pauses because, you know, you off script is like this disaster. It's like it's like a car tumbling in slow motion. It's like, when is he going to talk?
Hey, Chris, let's get out of here. Let them have at it. What do you say?
You doing any stand-up this weekend?
I'm just not obsessed with filling up space like you are. Okay?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying about the cake. I have this void inside of me that I need to fill with whatever's around. Do you understand? And the tension you're feeling is my draining you. Do you understand? I'm feeding here, Jim. Do you get it?
You're a drainer.
Oh, come on. Don't call
me. And
I'm
an enabler.
Oh, thank God. You want to get married?
Ooh.
Is your wife is arriving soon? Isn't she?
But can't you marry one of each sex? Is that all right? You know, if you're just married to the
in Utah
to the woman, can you marry a male guy as well?
I have no idea. What are you asking me this stuff? I'm not your therapist.
I missed therapy yesterday. That's a problem. You know, and there's a lot of people out there right now. You know what they're saying, Jim?
They're saying, this is incredible radio.
Exactly. They're saying, this is incredible radio. Why don't they talk about something relevant? Why don't they talk about something important? How do we activate ourselves? Why don't they tell us what we should do to help the country? What is going on in the world right now? That's what they're saying, Jim. Nothing?
Right now, yeah. Right now, the New York City Council is debating a law that will require makers of computer monitors to collect and recycle their discarded devices.
Are you making that?
What? Up? No, yeah. True.
You're really good at delivering the news.
Yeah.
Maybe you should get a job as like a journalist or a newsreader or something. Maybe this character thing isn't the end all for you.
Maybe you're right.
You want to see how if we can really just dump this segment in the toilet? Like, do you want to just...
hey, where's that Koran? Time's up. Morgan Spurlock next. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour, Air America's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
It's Friday morning. The nationwide average for a gallon of gas, philosopher kings, geniuses, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. Today is $2.15. That's down 9 cents from a month ago, but still 15 cents higher than a year ago. Sorry, folks. If you're traveling a long way, it's going to cost you some money. And I say, when you're in doubt, blame the president.
Absolutely. And if you're going out and you got to choose between the SUV and the Prius, take the Prius.
Put the kids in a trailer and hook it up to the Prius. You want to come see Riley and I do whatever we're doing here today live. Next week we'll be at the City Bakery. That's June 3rd, next Friday, here in New York City on 18th Street between 5th and 6th Avenue from 6 to 9 a.m. Come watch the magic unfold.
That's right.
The Cardinal will be there. We'll have some interesting guests. We'll have some croissants. And I think we're on a croissant countdown right now as we speak.
There you go.
Because you know how I get. I almost made Clutch Larson cry over croissants a few weeks ago. But I think everything's going to be all right today. Hey, Riley, you're going to be
where?
On the road to City Hall tonight. Is that it?
That's it. 7:30 this evening. Reporters Roundtable.
New York 1.
Yep.
Watch it. It's very important to see Riley on television. A lot of people don't know what you look like.
So well, I mean, we do local stuff. I love to do local New York stuff.
I know.
New York is a crazy place.
We should talk about that stadium thing. Let's talk about it right now. To heck with it.
George W. Bush.
You know what? Let me do the iNews first.
Yeah, go ahead.
We're going to talk about this stadium issue because this is it's a national issue now. I think it's actually.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, here you go. Sometimes it's hard to understand the headlines when you just look at them, but thank God we got this machine. Look at that thing. Huh? There's the iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator. Let's kick it up and feed it some headlines on Friday. That never gets stale. If only you could see Brendan P.W. McDonald do that live. Hilarious. Level-headed cat. But next Friday, you just told me, next Friday he's going to do a live. He's going to do a live at City Bakery. Let's feed this thing some headlines. From the New York Times, Democrats force Senate to delay a vote on Bolton. Democrats force Senate to delay a vote on Bolton. Translation, Bolton dons Vader mask, vows, the more you delay me, the more terrible will be my vengeance.
Oh, Lord.
From the Washington Post, North Korea denies nuclear testing reports. From the Washington Post, North Korea denies nuclear testing reports. Translation, North Korea accuses U.S. of insane dictator profiling. Let's read it again. North Korea denies nuclear testing reports. Translation, second one, North Korea announces new plutonium-fueled grain silos.
let's do it one more time.
Translation, North Korea denies nuclear testing reports. Top Korean chefs announce new plutonium-enriched kimchi.
Oh.
Hey. It's just getting worse. From Associated Press, battle lines drawn over primetime condom ads. Battleline Drawn over Primetime, Condomat Translation, Networks, OK, Primetime, Autopsies, Murder and Crime, Draw a Line and Say Sex.
Oh, yeah.
I like this. Battleline Drawn over Primetime, Condomat. Execs reject Condomat deal as inconvenient and insensitive, decide to pull out.
Ooh.
What is wrong? What is that?
Oh, baby, that?
Now you got to be doing the O too, Kalo. I got to get O from you as well. Oh,
what is that? It's a sex joke.
Sex joke.
Oh, Mr. No.
Sexual diminuendo.
You're above sex jokes. I'm sorry. What happened? Did you become a Christian over the day? What happened?
That wasn't an O as in I'm offended. It was like
Andrew Dice Clay type.
You misinterpreted my O apparently.
And I feel bad. I just said, did you become a Christian? I just meant, did you become
I think I am Christian.
Okay. You know, I am what I am too, but I don't let it affect the way I feel about sex. I don't let it filter anything. You know what I'm saying?
So you
say?
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. Am I filtering something about sex?
You know, this is going nowhere. What do you want? What?
Free gum? I used to love the fat guys.
Yeah. All right. So there you go.
You're picking on a poor, defenseless Chris Lopresto.
No, I'm not. He's not defenseless.
He doesn't have his machine, so he can fire back.
I can still fire back.
He can still fire back.
Oh. You go on. Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. So Riley, we've got like 3 minutes.
Yeah.
What about? So the stadium deal is now Bush is getting involved in the West Side Stadium here in New York City because? So
George W. Bush has put his big paw print in the West Side Stadium, apparently lobbying a couple of the people who may not want it to happen, those being two local officials here in New York State, Joe Bruno, the head of the state Senate, and Sheldon Silver, the Speaker of the Assembly. George W. Bush must be promising something to these guys because he thinks now, all of a sudden, that this West Side Stadium is crucial to the Olympic bid. Now, it has been all along. This is the 2012 Olympics. I don't know whether somebody just woke him up and told him yesterday or whatever, but now he's been working behind the scenes. Apparently, Andrew Card has contacted Joe Bruno. They're both Republicans. I guess they can, you know, talk to each other. And my guess is that they want, you know, that Shelley Silver and Joe Bruno want something for their respective districts from the feds that Bush will provide. Maybe we'll even get a Second Avenue subway here in New York out of the deal, huh?
So you think that's what he wants? That's like the negotiations here. You know, see, this kind of stuff always amazes me that you can see the nuance of politics just on a city level, a community level.
Mm-hmm.
You really realize that it's all about barter. It's all about compromise. It's all about territory. It's all about money.
Yin and yang, baby. They want something in exchange for their support. Bruno and Silver belong to a very small thing called the Public Authorities Control Board. They have to green light this. They control that board, the two of them and the governor, three people. All three of them have to sign off in order to get this done.
And this would be a huge stadium. This would be Jet Stadium.
Jet Stadium, 70,000 seats.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that would bring a lot of people on the West Side. They don't want to have nothing to do with this thing. It's going to cause traffic jams. It's going to cause a lot of backup.
It's been a very controversial issue. It's an issue in the New York City mayoral race as well.
Well, you know, I don't know if you know if people out there, most of you know, because most people have seen this movie. Morgan Spurlock, the man behind the documentary Supersize Me, is going to be with us in just a few minutes. He's got a new book out, Don't Eat This Book, Fast Food and the Supersizing of America. And he's got this new TV show that I really want to talk to him about because it sounds like a pretty great idea to me. And also, you know, before the end of the show at some point, I really want to address this Tom DeLay story. The guy is, you know, someone who worked for him, the head of his pack, one of
Trim Pack,
yeah, Trim Pack, you know, is in trouble. He just got accused in a civil suit, and you know, had to pay $200,000, which doesn't bear well
Bodewell.
Bodewell. That's it. Bodewell for DeLay. And now this guy's pissed off about somebody making a joke about him on Law and Order.
He better be pissed off about a possible indictment.
Well, what the hell is wrong with these guys? Like, what do you get mad at television? It's not a boob. You know, it's not sex.
He is the government, Mark Maron. He doesn't think he should be subject to this sort of thing.
What an idiot.
You don't joke about Tom, though. You don't joke about the hammer.
All right, we'll be back with Morgan Spurlock. Well, you know, we're going to sit here and wait till he gets here, actually.
Morning Sedition on the air. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
18 past the hour. Welcome back. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program.
Yay! All right, man. It's Friday. It's a Friday before Memorial Day. It is. We're pleased at this point to have in our studio. I don't know if you know Morgan Spurlock's work, but he's best known as the writer and director of Super Size Me. He's written a new work called Don't Eat This Book, Fast Food and the Supersizing of America. His new TV show, 30 Days, premieres on June 15th on FX. You're doing everything. I mean, Supersize Me became the third highest grossing documentary of all time. It was nominated for an Academy Award. And now here he is in the studio. Morgan Spurlock, I remember you, man. But now you're bigger than life. You finally hit it big, huh? I mean, you went from, you know, giving people money to eat poo to sort of
eating it myself.
Yeah, eating poo yourself.
That's right.
What was that show on MTV called?
We had a show called I Bet You Will.
Oh, my God. They used to give people money. They'd just say, here's $50. How about eat some poo?
And well, Divine did it for a lot less than that.
Not in the long run.
Those were the days.
Yeah. So what's going on with the DVD is out.
Yeah.
Once you, I mean, I don't know the whole story. I know you've probably talked about it before, but what inspired you to just start doing, you know, eating the McDonald's and doing the documentary?
Yeah, you know, I was sitting on my mom's couch. It was Thanksgiving, you know, 2002 when I got the idea for the movie. You know,
right.
And I grew up in a house where, you know, mom cooked dinner every day and there was good food around. And now this is right in the middle of those lawsuits when those two girls were suing McDonald's. When I first heard about this, I thought it was crazy. You know, that somebody would sue a food company that sells them food that they buy, that they eat, and then blame them for it.
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
And but then a spokesperson for McDonald's came on TV and he said, listen, you can't link our food to these girls being sick. You can't link our food to these girls being obese. Our food is healthy. It's nutritious. It's good for you.
Uh-huh.
And I said, well, I think you're getting a little ahead of yourself now.
Yeah.
And I said, because if it's that good for me, then realistically, shouldn't I be able to eat it for 30 days straight with no side effects?
And breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
And, yeah, snack, mm-hmm. desserts, the works.
Mm.
Yeah.
And obviously what happened is you got sick.
I got really sick.
How are you doing now?
I'm much better. Much better these days.
How sick did you actually get? I mean, what was the physiological impact of all that?
Oh, I mean, of course there was the weight gain. I gained 24.5 pounds. My cholesterol went up 65 points. My blood pressure went off the charts. My liver got so filled with fat that I was en route to giving myself what's called NASH syndrome, or non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, which will lead to hardening of the liver, cirrhosis of the liver, much like an alcoholic.
Oh, that's just an excuse. Let's be honest.
Yeah.
All right, and I was doing all that drinking.
Yeah.
Did you have any McDonald's stooges after you? Would they get the hamburger on you?
All the goons. All the McGoons chasing me around McDonald Land.
Yeah. That's a new thing. With the kitty in the little kitty park.
That's right.
Morgan Spurlock running around the playground there. Well, what happened? Did you get any flack?
Yeah, well, you know, in the U.S., in the United States, that they McDonald's themselves didn't really attack me. They just shrugged off the film. You know, they shrugged off, oh, this doesn't matter. He doesn't know what he's talking about. You know, because of the 46 million, they feed 46 million people a day.
On purpose?
Yeah, on purpose.
People eat there on purpose. Do you think it's mostly a convenience thing? I mean, obviously people like it.
Yeah.
But is it primarily, just from my knowledge of McDonald's, I won't eat there for a lot of reasons. And yeah. This was long before I saw your film. What I want to know is, do people eat there because they like it, or just because it's convenient, or just because they don't want to cook? Are they addicted? What do you think?
I think yes, 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 yes. I mean, I think you hit all the nails on the head. You know, I think that once, you know, once we dive into eating a lot of fat, sugary foods, we want more. You know, our body just kind of craves them.
Oh yeah.
And dude, you know, it's like we are a nation of instant consumers, of instant gratification.
Yeah.
We're driving down the road, and your stomach's like, and you're like, oh, look, there's a McDonald's. I'll go in the drive-thru.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh man, I'm all hungry.
Well, but you know, there's there is that sense that if you pull off the road and go into a McDonald's, you pretty much know what it is you're going to get. What role do you think that plays?
Well, I mean, I agree and disagree on some point. I mean, I think we have an idea, because what we always hear from people is, well, we all know it's bad for us. But I don't think we know, A, how bad it is for us, and B, we don't know what's in the food. You know, I mean, we don't know what we're getting. We're getting a science experiment, you know, that's called food.
Yeah.
You know, it's like there's a guy that I just wrote a book called Don't Eat This Book.
Right. It's sort of based on the film? Or?
Yeah, it basically expands a lot more on a lot of the stuff we just kind of touched on in the movie.
Did you hire a research team?
I had a couple of different researchers, like, knocking out the knock-up research with me. And there was a... There was a guy, and there's a guy in Vermont who, for the last 13 years, has had a McMuseum of food on his shelf. He's got 13 years worth of McDonald's food, burgers, quarter pounders that has been sitting there, hasn't decomposed, hasn't broken down, hasn't molded.
That's
nothing.
True.
It's true.
There's always a guy in Vermont with something like that. Isn't
and he's got guns and an arsenal.
So it hasn't decomposed at all. That means it's full of preservatives, obviously.
It's full of something.
Eating patterns in the black community sometimes can be a little bit different, and particularly for single mothers with small kids, mm-hmm. McDonald's represents an air-conditioned, safe, secure environment beyond the food.
And in a lot of neighborhoods, across the country, that's the only place where there is a playground in a lot of neighborhoods, where they can take the families, where the kids can go. And so that's what's frightening. In the United States, there's 8,000 playgrounds that are owned and operated by fast food restaurants.
I remember when the Big Mac came out.
Yeah.
When I was a kid. I was like, you remember that?
It was
like,
ideal.
Oh, my God. And it had the little cardboard circle around it.
Yeah.
That had 100% pure beef patties.
I think they were like 60 cents or something. They were real cheap when they started.
Came in the styrofoam containers.
Yeah. Oh,
the styrofoam Pac-Man containers.
All that goop. They still make those, don't they?
They still make those. Although I think they're a little smaller these days. They're a little smaller and have even more calories in them.
Now they have the McGriddle.
The McGriddle.
Did you eat a lot of McGriddle?
Oh, of course I did. Come on. The McGriddle, which is the most fantastic yet scary, Frankenstein experiment ever. He goes, we're gonna take a bacon, egg, and cheese, put it between two pancakes, and we're going to cook the syrup right inside.
Yeah! Woo! Sweet and savory. Man, but you
that's
still
a win-win.
Do you eat it?
No, I don't eat any of McDonald's. I haven't been to a McDonald's in 2 years.
We're friends here. Come on.
Dude, I love a good burger.
Not even the fries? You don't eat the fries? Everybody's addicted to their fries.
Dude, their fries. Those things, we put those fries in a jar, and those things didn't decompose over 3 months.
Are you serious? Yeah. I thought the fries had some integrity.
Have you ever cleaned out your car? You find a fry underneath the seat? And you're like, oh, my God, I wonder how long that's been.
Cold, maybe, but not moldy.
Yeah,
it's hard, but it's not moldy. So what happens now? So the book is essentially a broadened thesis on stuff you did in the film.
Yeah, we look a lot more into, the federal school lunch programs, because in the United States, for me, schools are disgusting. What's happening in schools is terrible. Mm-hmm. It's like we basically sold out kids.
Mm-hmm.
Kids across America are going to school, and it's like they're eating lunch in the middle of 7-Eleven. French fries, candy, soda, ding dongs, ho hos. We shot in one school where they had a slushy machine in the lunchroom.
Oh yeah,
yeah, where the kids could get the cherry slushy or a Coke or Blue.
Is something wrong with that?
Yes.
There's actually I was at a elementary school once, and they had just a closet with just these glucose IVs where the kids would just put sugar right in their arm and just walking around the school, and it was cool. They take it off for sports PE class. McDonald's is one of our sponsors,
that's
Marty.
Right. Yeah, I know. We're done now.
Do a plug for McDonald's.
I got a question, though. I mean, at a point, it would seem to me that one of the ways you combat this is by showing the parents of kids how they can, make nutritious meals for the same price. And, I mean, you're talking about pretty low.
Or cheaper, yeah.
Yeah, or cheaper. I mean, the price point for a Happy Meal is usually about $2.75 or something.
Yeah.
You can make a healthy meal for that. Why aren't more parents doing it?
For me, I think you're hitting on a really big point in our country right now, and that's people don't know how to cook. When I grew up in a house, I'm sure it was the same for you guys, my mom would cook something on Sunday. Like, she'd cook a chicken on Sunday. Monday we had chicken sandwiches. Tuesday it was chicken soup. Wednesday it was chicken stew. Thursday it was chicken pot pie. Friday I'm like, man, please tell me there's no more chicken. And then she's like, nope, today it's roast beef. And the whole cycle would start again.
We used to pray my mother wouldn't cook.
Please.
Oh, my
please
God.
Don't.
Anything but her cooking. It's just awful. Still pretty bad. She doesn't like to eat, so she's not a very good cook.
Stay right there, okay, Morgan, because in a minute we want to ask you about your new TV show. I want to know, you did some pretty, crazy experiments, essentially human experiments, like living on minimum wage for 30 days, putting a homophobe in a house full of gay guys, sending a hardcore Christian to live with Muslims for a month. I want to hear all about that and how those things turned out when we return here on Air America Radio. 34 past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yeah.
This morning's edition here on Air America Radio. We're talking to Morgan Spurlock, director and star of the documentary Supersize Me. His new book is called Don't Eat This Book, Fast Food and the Supersizing of America. Riley, you eat fast food?
Hell no.
So what happens now for Morgan Spurlock? What's the next big project? You going to go to Iraq dressed as a military guy and see what happens?
Hold on, let me write that down.
What do you got going? What's the next extended prank that turns into a masterpiece?
Yeah, we're doing a TV show for FX that comes out June 15th, and it's a show called 30 Days, where each week we examine a different social issue in America by putting somebody in an environment or in a situation for a month and see how it affects them.
Oh, so you're actually going to get you're going to experiment with people's lives?
Yeah, in the premiere of the show on June 15th is me. So me and my girlfriend moved to Columbus, Ohio, and we asked what's it like to live on minimum wage in America. And so for 30 days we go there and we find minimum wage jobs. We have to find a place to live, and
uh-huh.
and we show just how impossible it is, how the deck is so stacked against you when you're working for these very minimum wage,
especially when you're not in a McDonald's.
That's right, exactly.
And you have to go.
But it was great. Well, luckily, because Alex is a great cook. She's a great chef. As we talked about in the movie. And so if it hadn't been for her, I mean, I'd have been totally screwed because she was. We were living on about $35 a week for groceries, and she made that. Work.
Now let me ask you, when you take that part, when
we
you go
take that, yes, we take
now,
that, sure.
What was it like the first time you went into your pocket and realized you didn't have any money?
Well, that's the thing. Like, even the very first day when we get there and you're in this habit of, oh, I'm going to go get a coffee now. Yeah. Oh, I'm hungry. I'm going to get a slice of pizza now. And here I was just going around Columbus looking for work and started getting hungry and started just having these cravings to where I just wanted to go buy and spend things, which, because we don't think about it, buying gum, buying anything. And so, suddenly when I reached in my pocket and I had $2, I got to keep that so I can get home.
What about the old credit card? How about
no credit card.
Mr. Visa? No, we didn't get ourselves into debt?
No, we did get ourselves into debt because over the course of the show, both of us ended up having to go to the hospital. We both ended up getting sick over the month. We had no health insurance, because most people on minimum wage don't.
Back up. So did you get sick on purpose for the sake of the show?
No, exactly.
Did you have someone come in and
check you?
Quick, give me that sour milk. No, it's like I was working a landscape job, and I basically sprained my wrist, and it started swelling up and turning black. And I thought I might have broken it, or at least somehow gotten a fracture.
Right.
Thank you.
So you really lucked out with the injury then,
on a narrative arc level. Yeah. And then Alex, and to make it even worse, she ended up getting a bladder infection.
Well, that's excellent. Excellent.
Great.
Oh,
yeah. Right for the show.
This is
heaven.
Oh, I can just see off camera. You're like, do you have a bladder infection? Excellent.
Yeah.
Roll them. We're on our way to the clinic.
Man, that's some scary
stuff. It's evil, but it's going to have an impact. So what other things you got planned for the 30 days? Or what are you going
to
do with other people?
Yeah, well, you were talking about me going to Iraq, but what we did is we're focusing on America. We're focusing on things here. And so we took a fundamentalist Christian from my home state of West Virginia, somebody who's pro-war, pro-us versus them. And, when he thinks of a Muslim, he thinks of a guy standing on a mountain with an AK-47. And so we took him away from his wife and his kids and moved him to Dearborn, Michigan, which is the largest.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I had no idea. This is the largest Muslim population in the United States.
Yes, it is.
And so for 30 days, he moves in with a Muslim family, basically forgives his religion, and becomes a Muslim. He dresses like a Muslim, eats as a Muslim, prays 5 times a day, reads the Quran daily, works with an imam, a Muslim cleric, who teaches him the history of Islam, what are the 5 pillars, why are they important.
Mm-hmm.
And the transformation this guy goes through in 30 days is remarkable.
Could he become a Muslim?
Not quite.
Oh, what happened?
He's still a Christian, but he just, uh-huh.
Did his attitude toward Muslims change?
Completely.
Yeah.
Completely.
What does he feel? How does he feel about him now?
He
hates him even more.
Yeah, exactly.
He's like, I knew it. Everything I thought was true.
I played along, Spurlock.
No, I mean, he ends up going back, and he really realizes, and he looks at it, and he's like, how can we demonize, 1.5 billion people for the acts of a few? I mean, it really was eye-opening for this guy.
That's a good show.
Yeah.
What's another one?
Another one is we took a guy who just came out of the military, a guy who's, a big don't ask, don't tell, supporter, believes that, he believes homosexuality is a sin against God,
mm-hmm.
that these people choose to be sinners.
Mm-hmm.
And he came from Michigan.
You're about to say, and we took him out and made him have sex with men.
For 30 days straight.
Every day. Not quite, but close.
Okay.
Yeah, no, we took him out of his home, the cocoon of his life in Michigan.
Yeah.
And we moved him to San Francisco to the Castro, where he moved in with a gay couple and basically saw what it was really like to be a homosexual in America.
That might be annoying for anybody.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not saying in a bad way, but you know, how much of that can you take?
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
All this dancing, all those show tunes.
I get the rainbow flag. I get it. Does there have to be one in every room?
Anyway,
the new book by Morgan Spurlock is called Don't Eat This Book, Fast Food and the Supersizing of America. His new TV show, 30 Days, premieres on June 15th on FX. Thank you for talking to us, Morgan. It was great seeing you. I'm glad things have really worked out for you. The show sounds very exciting. The book sounds good. Come by anytime.
Thank you very much, Mark. Appreciate it.
Oh, God. Okay. So we're going to talk about Tom DeLay in a minute. We're going to cover some of the news that we half covered earlier. Well, not half covered. You just might not.
We don't half cover nothing.
That's right.
Here.
You might have missed it. We want to refresh your memory. But first, let's take this call from Ted in Nebraska. How are you, Ted?
Good morning, Mark and Mark. Once again, the liberals are completely wrong on this stem cell issue.
Oh, no, it's happening. Oh, no, I hate when... help me, Riley. Oh, my God. Oh, no, it's happening. My thoughts are starting to change. I'm becoming him. Oh, no.
Now, Pennsylvania.
Live from Radio Halliburton, it's Right and Early, the conservative's way to wake up with Mark the Shark Maron.
Good morning, neocon. 34 past the hour here on Radio Halliburton, where the truth hurts. Hey, you know what? Mark the Shark has a new enemies list, and he is pissed. Look out, you seven so-called Republicans. You sold us out to the Democrats on the filibuster. Now step up and take your punishment, traitors. John Warner. Oh, Olympia Snow. Suffer, Susan Collins. Lindsey Graham. Nice name, dork. Eat that, Mike DeWine. Yeah, here's a little sugar for you, Lincoln J.V. Oh, and I didn't forget you, John McCain. I'm John McCain, and I'll do anything to be president. Oh, pity me. I was a POW in Vietnam, so I'm used to collaborating with the enemy. Viet Cong, Democrats, I love them all. My penis fell off.
Oh,
you ever heard the word majority? That means we tell them what to do, stupid. Dance, you Democrats. Dance faster, faster. Whoa. What's the matter? Tired? You've been sharp. Hey, it's 36 past the hour. We'll take a call. You're on the air, caller.
Tommy Pinko, liberal New Yorker reader.
Good point, caller. Those traitors should have to marry the Democrats they got into bed with. McCain and Lieberman, I now pronounce you wife and wife. You may now kiss my ass.
I'm George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
Hey, it's 38 after the hour. Time for the Neocon Farm Report. Oh, looks like we got a big old herd of stem cells headed for the slaughterhouse. Way to go, Democrats. Keep killing babies. It's the other white meat. Stick around, Neocons. We'll be back with Toby Keith.
Don't touch that dial, Patriot. We'll be back with Right and Early.
Why is my nose bleeding?
Are you okay, man?
What the hell just happened? Wow, did I black out again?
You must have, because I heard you say something about white meat.
Oh man, I'm gonna have to listen to these shows. I think you guys are pulling something over on me here. Not us. I feel like I lost some time.
Well,
so look, you know, when I want to talk about Tom DeLay, and he's like, you know, out of all things to be angry at, now he's angry at Law and Order, the television show, after one of his buddies just got nailed with a lawsuit for corrupt campaign fund stuff. We'll get into that, and we'll, you know, have some closing comments as the conversation continues here on Morning Sedition, Air America.
Morning Sedition.
Just wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Thank you.
pull it in here. 47 past the hour. 48 just turned. Look at that clock. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Yeah.
It's Mark and Mark on Morning's Edition here on Air America Radio. If you want to come see us live in person, make the magic that we make here every day. We will be broadcasting live next Friday, June 3rd, from City Bakery in New York, right here in New York City, 18th Street between 5th and 6th Avenue, from 6 to 9. The Cardinals are going to be there. We're going to have guests. We're going to have free stuff. There's going to be coffee. There's going to be plenty of room.
Yeah.
It's a big place down there.
Yeah, man.
And we just got the City Bakery goods here, and now I'm stuffed with croissants and everything else. Oh,
so don't, we don't have a tape bit for the rest of the show, man, because I'm feeling kind of sleepy.
We got Mark Riley.
Where?
We'll be on Road to City Hall on New York One tonight at 7:30, Riley.
That's right. Only available on cable.
Are you prepared?
I'm always prepared.
I was born ready, he says. So what do you got planned for this weekend? Anything?
I'm actually going to go see my daughter's piano instructor is doing a recital at Carnegie Hall. So I'll get some highbrow culture over this.
That's
weekend.
Some highbrow instruction your daughter's getting.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
It's going to be, is it a man or a woman?
No, it's a woman. A woman
named
Chungmi Nam.
Solo at Carnegie Hall?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Man, how's Vivica playing piano?
She's getting good, man. She plays what used to be my mother's favorite tune,
mm-hmm.
Which is a Beethoven piece, and she plays it beautifully. She plays it better than my mother did.
God, I wish someone would have made me play piano when I was a kid. I wish someone would have made me play, would have made me done my homework. My mom made me play guitar.
My mother tried to make me do my homework. Yeah. I defied her.
Yeah, I love playing guitar. I love practicing guitar. But,
really?
Yeah, but it's weird. When somebody tells you to practice something, it's not as fun as just doing it. I remember when she goes, go practice for 15 minutes. I'm like, all right, if we do Johnny Be Good twice, that'll be 7 minutes. And if we do that Cat Stevens song, that'll be another 3 minutes, and we're done with it.
10 minutes. Well, let me tell you something. My daughter goes to piano lessons with some people. I mean, there's an 8-year-old girl, but same age as my daughter. She sounds like Horowitz, for God's sake, when she starts playing. She's incredible.
That's an amazing instrument. I wish I knew. Kale, are you playing anything?
No. My parents never really gave a crap.
Oh,
wow. That's going to be... Well,
I guess your mom and dad don't listen to the show. Huh?
Oh. I get that, but Mark Maron, King Baby.
I'm sorry. It's amazing. It's amazing. Oh, okay. All right. You're right. Let me do it for myself. I'm sorry, buddy. I just haven't used that button in a while. I figured, why not throw that in there?
That was good.
So, let's talk about this delay thing real quick, because I think it's baffling. I'm very excited that this guy, the treasurer of a political action committee formed by House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, broke the law by not reporting hundreds of thousands of dollars in campaign contributions and was nailed for it in a civil suit.
That's right.
But this is not the same as a criminal suit, obviously, but I think it still has its implications. This guy is related to DeLay. Very directly, DeLay knew about this stuff. It just makes him look worse and worse and worse. Am I right?
Well, it makes him look worse and worse and worse. But see, what's interesting is that DeLay's legal advisors, it's amazing to me how quickly people will shed load when someone is accused or found to have done wrongdoing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here's what Bobby Birchfield, one of Tom DeLay's legal advisors, says. Quote, the decision doesn't mention Tom DeLay, which confirms that he really has no involvement in and has never had any involvement in that particular litigation. In other words, the stooge is on his own.
Right. Well, they try to cut them all off, cut them all loose, but after a certain point, if there's a number, how many can there be,
Yeah.
You got, what's his name, Abram...
Jack Abramoff. Yeah,
Abramoff. You got a bunch of other people trying to distance themselves from DeLay. I mean, at some point, it's just sort of like, the guy stinks.
Well, Trimpact, this organization he founded, essentially became a gerrymandering machine. That's all they did. They redrew district lines in Texas to make sure, A, that the legislature would remain Republican, and B, that the congressional delegation would remain Republican.
What a racket.
Yeah, and this was the time mark, by the way, when they sent state troopers from Texas into Oklahoma to find the Democrats.
Hold up at a hotel.
Yeah,
right?
Hold up at a hotel. There is no length to which this guy will not go.
And the hilarious thing to me is, we pulled this off of Drudge Report,
that they're in a new Law and Order episode, a judge killer is tied to a delay fan. Apparently, the transcript of the episode, False-Hearted Judges, in the season finale, detectives Gorin and Ames suspect an imprisoned white supremacist is behind the shootings of a judge's family, but their investigation widens when an appellate judge is later murdered. And apparently, they're looking for a guy. There's a joke here. Maybe we should put out an APB for somebody in a Tom DeLay shirt. That was a joke made by one of the characters.
Well, yeah. Shut right? production.
Right. But, well, that's what DeLay's like. DeLay's making a complaint, apparently.
I don't know to who. What? To the FCC?
Well, that's just the thing. It's like, this is one of those things where, you know, he's going to try it. What's he going to do? Try and pawn it off as the liberal media, as media bias? It's a fictional show that has every right to make jokes about it. When somebody takes something like that so personal, you know he's guilty and he's desperate and he's in trouble.
Well, you know what he's going to do, don't you?
What?
He's going to get his minions at the Parents Television Council and the Family Research.
On what?
Though? They'll go to the people that advertise on that show and say, we're going to boycott unless you take back or apologize for or never agree never again to mention the word of our father, Tom DeLay.
Right, but I just don't think there's any traction there. I think this is one of those things where it's like, why would Bozell even get involved? It would make him look like an idiot. I mean,
Bozell's not worried about looking like an idiot.
Like more of an idiot, but it's not even a sexual issue. It's just this guy's name.
Look, they're friends. What counts.
But if somebody is this humorless, if this is what he's going after, this and stem cells, like, mm-hmm. This guy will stand up for any sort of religious fanaticism, any sort of religious fanatic cause, because he knows those guys, those people, those minions will always forgive him. But to go after a TV show for making an aside, what a child.
One very simple word explains all this. Mm. Diversion.
Exactly.
That's what it is.
That's exactly
right. As long as he can keep people focused on Law and Order criminal intent, no one will be focused on his alleged criminal intent.
I feel bad for people who are traveling this weekend. The New York area, the weather's supposed to be a little crappy.
A little hinky.
Yeah, yeah. But gas prices, nationwide average, $2.15.
A mere bag of shells.
15 cents higher than a year ago. And I say, blame Bush. When in doubt, blame Bush. I, myself, what am I going to do this weekend, Riley?
Yeah, what are you doing this
my
weekend?
My wife went home.
She went home?
She went back to Los Angeles.
You should follow her.
Yeah, I could. Maybe I should have went out to L.A. But I think I'm going to, you know what I'm going to do? I'm not going to do any comedy. I'm just going to hang out. I'm going to try and relax. I'm going to take care of myself. Maybe I'll go back to the Russian baths.
Yeah, or you could go, you know, if it's warm enough, you could go to the now legendary Astoria Pool. You ever been there?
No, it's not open yet.
Oh, it's not. Oh, well, this is Memorial Day weekend. All the pools and parks in New York open up. Coney Island opens up.
It's like cold out.
Yeah, it's going to be 70-something here. Knockwood, yeah. It's going to get warmer today as the day goes on.
Not quite swimming weather. So I'm going to watch you on the road to City Hall tonight on New York 1 at 7:30. And for those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we already talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. The FBI says the cost to upgrade its computer system is still unknown. The biggest cost came from trying to find out some way to block emails from that guy in Nigeria who always needs help with his bank account. A Law and Order program takes heat from Republicans for a line suggesting that the killer of a judge was wearing a Tom DeLay t-shirt. I don't know which Republican is complaining about this, but maybe we should look for someone wearing a whiny bitch t-shirt. Whoever wrote that line is number one of the new Hollywood 10.
Yes.
There you go. A Florida researcher, nicknamed Dr. Beach, named a St. Petersburg beach the best beach in America. Florida Governor Jeb Bush expressed his delight that a beach in his state had been named number one, but added, it's the kind of thing Terri Schiavo would have enjoyed if the liberals hadn't murdered her.
Oh, my God.
Next year, Dr. Beach is getting together with Dr. Death to publish the top 10 places to commit suicide while tanning. Today's phrase, if you could, just drop it into conversation. So Law and Order took a shot at DeLay, huh? Remember when they used to criticize politicians on the news? Wake up, sheeple. They're all sleeping together, and we get the couch.
Closing
your Morning Sedition Cliff Notes for today. On Monday, we're going to have a show. It's going to be a catered show, or a hosted show.
Catered and hosted.
Yes, it's going to be the best of show, of Morning Sedition. But it's going to be hosted by our own Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman. Brendan P.W. McDonald is going to be here working on Memorial Day with Kalo.
Congratulations.
Working on Memorial Day. How are you feeling about that, Kalo?
Oh, fantastic. Thanks, Dan.
Yeah.
All right, and so look forward to that. And I guess you and I will be back Tuesday and next Friday.
We'll be back Tuesday. Friday, City Bakery, yo.
Have a good weekend, Mark.
Have a good weekend. This is Air America Radio.